Well, it's a pleasure being here and being on a panel with such interesting folks. I was wondering when George was talking about how some people think college reduces smoking. My question was, smoking what? I think you can make a pretty strong case that college increases smoking. And, of course, I agree with almost everything Rich said. But I was disappointed, Rich, because you haven't taken my advice, my very important advice, into consideration. I told Rich, I said, Rich, don't go public with this information until after I retire. He retired before he went public with it, so he should have taken me into consideration. My assignment today is not to talk about my views of education, although I'll manage to slip a little bit in on my views. Why wait? I'll start right now. Actually, my view on education is quite simple. Based on Herbert Spencer's insight that it takes varied iterations to force alien concepts upon reluctant minds. But that's not my purpose. My purpose is not to talk about what I think about education. It's to talk about and discuss the comments of what Ben Rogge, what his views are on education, we're on education. Not all of his views, but views primarily regarding the role of the state in providing and financing education. Now, Ben Rogge was an economist, which, by the way, did not prevent him from being a man of great wit, charm, and insights into the human condition, with his insights heavily drawing, I might add, on his understanding of economics. Rogge was a very good economist for a number of reasons, but one very important reason was that he stood out was because he took Herbert Spencer's insight, the one I just mentioned, on education very seriously. Rogge understood that economic concepts are alien to most people. The concepts are quite simple, but the implications are often very counterintuitive. For example, here's one implication of a simple economic concept. This follows this directly from opportunity cost, that the real wages of a country's workers are reduced by import restrictions that protect them against competition from lower paid foreign workers. Another implication is counterintuitive and follows directly from private property, and that is that you're more likely to run out of a renewable resource than you are to run out of a non-renewable resource. I've asked many people to name one non-renewable resource we've ever run out of, and I've never heard an example given. We've run out of lots of renewable resources, primarily particular types of animals. But those are counterintuitive results that flow directly from very simple concepts. And Rogge had a natural knack for reiterating economic concepts and their implications in straightforward and entertaining ways that made them seem less alien and therefore much more understandable. Now, this contrast with the approach that many economists who never recover from what they learn in graduate school. And what most economists learn in graduate school is how to take extremely simple ideas and render them completely incomprehensible. That's the way we get tenure. Rogge spent his career at Wabash College in Crawfordsville, Indiana, and was a good friend and confidant of Pierre Goodrich, the founder of Liberty Fund. And my comments today on education are largely taken and inspired by the paper by Rogge and Pierre Goodrich titled Education in a Free Society, which was first published in 1973 and was a chapter in a book that Rogge published in 1979 called Can Capitalism Survive?, which was published by Liberty Fund. And in that article, Rogge and Goodrich considered a good education as being absolutely essential if we were to have a society consistent with free and responsible individuals. And their fundamental argument was that in such a society, education was not a proper choice, not a proper function for the state to be involved in. And in making that argument, they anticipated what they thought some people would consider a bit of a paradox. They were afraid that some people would argue, well, without the state having some influence over educational choices, we are not likely to get education that promotes an understanding and appreciation for the desirability of freedom. Well, they dismissed that as being a paradox. They dismissed that as being a real consideration. And they argued that state intervention into educational choices is both unnecessary and undesirable as a way to influence and assure that education serves the cause of freedom. They pointed out that the most effective advocates for limited government and individual liberty have typically not been paid agents of the state, and that publicly supported education is more often than not a training ground for those who attack the principle of limited government and freedom. So their uncompromising position is that the state should have nothing to do with educational arrangements, except, of course, as the state protects citizens from fraud and force in this area as well as other areas. Well, as a bit of an aside, it should be pointed out that protecting against fraud in education is a tough assignment. In one sense, most education throughout history can be seen as fraud, and I exaggerate a little bit here, but interesting article, it's really apocryphal, more as a fantasy, written by George Stigler back in the 70s, and it was titled A Sketch of History of the History of Truth in Teaching, in which students got the right to sue their professors and universities for intellectual malpractice. And in the decision establishing this right, the judge states, "It seems paradoxical beyond endurance to rule that a manufacturer of shampoos may not endanger a student's scalp, but a premier educational institution is free to stuff his skull full of nonsense." And also in this judgment, this hypothetical judgment that Stigler talked about, the field of economic development was abolished entirely. It was against the law to teach economic development because the point was that no university could afford to pay for the damages that its teachers did. Of course, Stigler was not being entirely serious. You can certainly make the case that education could not perform its proper function without generating and distributed large loads of nonsense. Improving knowledge is obviously a process of revealing error, trying things out, trying out new ideas, having a free competition of ideas, most of which will be discarded and mercilessly forgotten or discovered to be so ridiculous that they're worth saving for amusement. There's certainly some ideas like that, like the idea that's actually taught today and it's very popular, that the way to lower the cost of health care is by increasing the subsidy in its consumption. Now, that I hope that idea hangs around for a long time, but as a source of amusement, not to be taken seriously. But the academy is not always the best place to root out erroneous, even fraudulent ideas. Rogge and Goodrich write in this article I'm talking about that a thoroughly dishonest man can probably last longer under the umbrella of occupational blessedness and teaching or in the ministry than in the world of business. And when you throw in government funding of education and research into the mix, you strengthen the life-extending effect of truly ridiculous and bogus ideas. The obviously adds support to Rogge's and Goodrich's argument against government involvement in education. State support of education has surely increased the ability of mistaken and in some cases fraudulent ideas to persist by making it more difficult for new ideas that are disruptive of established interest to compete with those favoring the status quo, or worse yet, to replace or to protect ideas that are used for expanding government powers. So you can certainly make a case that, based on this, that Rogge and Goodrich were right. We shouldn't have any government involvement in education. But as Jim Buchanan is fond of pointing out, in policy reform, we always start from where we are. And where we are is with an educational system that is largely operated and funded by government and heavily influenced by political considerations. So even if we agree entirely with Rogge and Goodrich's objective of eliminating government-funded education, we'd be wise to make the case as effectively as possible. And that means operating at least initially within the existing educational structure, undermining the structure from within, so to speak. Buchanan is also fond of pointing out that there's a fundamental distinction between making decisions on the rules that we play by and making decisions within the rules that currently exist. And I doubt that Rogge or Goodrich would disagree with either of these points that Buchanan makes, but how do you operate within the existing structure to arrive at rules that will start us on the path towards freedom in education? And interestingly, one policy change in public education that many believe would make a good beginning on this path is a policy that Rogge and Goodrich do not address, and it's the policy of educational vouchers. They make much the same argument for private education that voucher advocates make for vouchers. At the end of their paper, they point out the advantages of having payments for education coming directly from the student or the student's parents rather than from the government. But in none of Rogge's writings, either in the book that I'm now editing on Rogge's writings, it will be coming out by Liberty Fund next year, or in Capitalism, Can Capitalism Survive, or any other writings of Rogge, do I see anything about educational vouchers. It might be there somewhere, but I just haven't seen it. Educational vouchers are obviously a halfway measure to protecting education against political influence. And likely Rogge and Goodrich are being strategic by staking out what most will consider an extreme position towards the elimination of government entirely from education in order to make halfway measures seem more reasonable. However, when making a case for full pricing of higher education in the book, Can Capitalism Survive, Rogge makes the case that traditional arrangements, that is subsidized higher education, cannot be changed quickly or with ease. And with this in mind, he acknowledges that we have a need for intermediate steps. So it's not at all clear what Rogge's view on educational vouchers was, either certainly at any level whatsoever. He certainly knew about vouchers, and he knew the arguments for them, but he never really seemed to take a position on them, although there's reasons to think that as a halfway measure, he would be sympathetic with it. And this reminds me of the late Marshall Fritz, who founded the movement Separation of Church and State. Marshall was opposed to vouchers, and several times I heard him publicly give me credit for convincing him that vouchers were a bad idea. And although I felt honored that he credited me with such persuasiveness, I always felt a little awkward about this honor, since I supported vouchers and still do. Marshall said that the blinding light, and I exaggerate a little bit here, but the blinding light that led him to his conversion was an article I wrote in 1986 entitled The Political Economy of Educational Vouchers. It appeared in the Freeman. And I didn't really think of the article as opposing vouchers so much as recognizing some political reality associated with them, and particularly the same political considerations that allowed the interest of the public school lobby to trump the interest of students, the very reason we want vouchers, would still be operating, if somehow less effectively, to undermine the advantages of any viable, politically viable voucher program. So I still see vouchers as a move in the right direction. But in conclusion, the paper with Pierre Goodrich exemplifies the soft and gentle and often humorous approach that Ben Rogge was so effectively able to use to make a powerful case for freedom. He was even more soft and gentle than Rich Vedder is. Maybe not quite as humorous at times, but always humorous. And I would encourage all of you to get a copy of Rogge's Can Capitalism Survive? From Liberty Fund, and in a few months get a copy of A Maverick's Defense of Freedom that will be published by Liberty Fund in next year. And I promise you that if you do, you will enjoy an approach to economics that, if not always a thrill a minute, is at least a smile a minute, and very often a chuckle is thrown in. I think it will make you appreciate, those who are not professional economists will make you appreciate that economics can be make a good case for freedom and be entertaining too. And I'll also encourage you, I hope you picked it up last night, to read Ed Faulkner's presidential essay for 2008, which he discusses, gives you a nice summary of what Rogge's contribution was, and also has an article by him, The Case for Economic Freedom. Thank you very much.